likes the women, always champions the nuns. And we have tough guys like Mahakajayana, who's trying to be alone, doesn't seem to have disciples. No Dhamma talks are handed down to us from him. But he's always critical. You know? He's critical of Ananda. He's critical of other people who are younger monks. He's critical of monks in general. And then we have people who are very analytic, yeah? Sariputta, very gifted analytic mind. And then we have people who are very fascinated with esoteric stuff. A man called Anuruddha, yeah? Who is gifted as a meditator, but is all very, very fascinated by devas and other realms and, you know, going to other systems. And so today we would call him a space cadet. And it has always been inspiring to me to see these different people, yeah, right there. They always indicated health to me. A community that can hold diversity is a healthier community than a monolithic community, or a community which you have only one type of person in there. It's a lot healthier if something is diverse. So when I came into this monastery, I enjoyed being able to stay there. Nobody asked me to pay a bill. Nobody asked me how much money I earned. You know, so I was very grateful to learn. By that time, I had already become a Buddhist practitioner. I was practicing Japanese Zen, which doesn't put so much emphasis on sutta study. And the psychological sophistication of the Zen I encountered wasn't very great. You know, it basically consisted in sit down, stare at the wall, don't believe anything that happens in your head. Yeah? Don't move, pull back your chin, don't sleep. If you do, we hit you. Actually, we expect you to ask to be hit before. And I was grateful. This was exactly the sort of teaching I needed, you know. I wouldn't have gone for the stuff I'm teaching today, you know. That wouldn't have been interesting to me. What I need was people with black skirts threatening to hit me when I fall asleep or when I move. This is exactly what I needed. And to people who tell me not to believe anything that happens between my ears when I meditate. Yeah? So this is precisely the sort of teaching I needed. Today I know, even in terms of Zen teaching, there is a lot more sophistication in Zen teaching than what I heard then. So I don't want to blame what I understood on my teachers, just to be clear. Yeah? But for me, this was precisely the right thing. And when I came to other forms of Buddhism, which had monastics, I was very grateful because these monastics, they were there the whole day, not just during a sesshin. You know, they lived there. When they went to the dentist, they would wear their Buddhist robes. Yeah? So I was impressed with that. And I felt invited to go and help in the monastery, to go and live there and offer my energy, help build, help run the place, and in return I would receive teachings. Yeah? And I was very grateful that this existed. I remember the first day when I came off a retreat, and I moved from the retreat center into the monastery. There were Thai people coming to visit to feed the monks. And I was sitting there with my grubby black trousers after having done some garden work the whole morning. And the Thai people, when they had fed the monks, they came down to me. And they started trying to feed me. And they said, no, this is an error. You know, I don't belong here, actually. I'm just visiting. And the Thai people said, doesn't matter, you're here. Look, we feed you. And they insisted on putting food. I had a tray prepared, you know, a sort of metal bowl for myself, which the lay people and the monks were finished, and the nuns would go and partake of the food. So I was waiting with that. And the Thai people insisted on putting food in my alms bowl, and I realized they're really serious about this. They're really serious about feeding me. They don't know me. They don't feed me because I'm a good meditator. They didn't know I was doing gardening work that morning, so it wasn't a reward. Yeah, they were just giving to me. They were just practicing dana. This was the most normal thing to them. Now, for me, a Swiss, you don't give people food, yeah? If you give people food in Switzerland, it means you think they don't have enough to feed themselves, yeah? It's an insult, basically. You do that to good friends, maybe, yeah? You feed them, or if you want to spoil somebody. But if you give strangers food, this is a strange thing to do in Switzerland, yeah? So I come there with my little Swiss mind, and people give me food. And I sit there, and, you know, suddenly I see that basically my tears are dripping into that food. Yeah, because I realized these people were immensely generous in ways I had never experienced in my life. You know, I grew up reasonably privileged, average neurotic family. Not very rich, not very poor either. Very mediocre sort of background, so. But these people were just genuinely giving and feeding in a most direct way. They were giving me something that I needed to sustain myself. And that gesture I found so powerful. Later I joined the monastic community, and you know, you're grateful after a while, you realize after a few years your body is an alms food body. Yeah. And it becomes normal in some ways. You don't think. When you're a monk, you don't always think, I'm a monk, I'm a monk, I'm a monk, you know. So what? You know, you're a monk. There's many monks. You know? There's been monks for thousands of years. In Thailand, there's 250,000 monks. Even in England, there's dozens of them. So it was a normal thing. You don't think about it in deep, profound ways every week. But when I went on pilgrimage in India, and I was completely dependent on people to feed me, I had no money, and I had only a ticket in and a ticket out. And we wanted to walk the holy sites, my monk friend and I. He's an Austrian guy, he's a very fine teacher himself. We walked, and as you know, there's not many Buddhists in India. Yeah, Buddhism died out in India about 900 years ago. So we walked through mainly non-Buddhist India, and why should non-Buddhist people give Buddhist monks food? So there is no good reason why this should happen, and yet it did happen. Yeah, I lived many months in India as an alms mendicant, and I've only lost 1 kilo when I was in India. So out of 4.5 months' time there, maybe I missed 1 or 2 days of food, but on all other days, people gave monks food, yeah. Muslim people, Hindu people. They didn't know about me. They didn't know about monks. They kept asking us how many children we had. Yeah. And we told them we don't have children. They say, what's wrong with your women? They say, look, we think a little different about family. We're monks, you know. So in India, sadhu has long hair and a long beard, and Buddhist monks are shaven head and shaven beard. So it takes a little bit of adjustment. But people realized that we were spiritual practitioners, and it was their genuine good-heartedness. And also religious teaching, you know, Vedic religious, Hindu religious teaching that says, if you have a guest, you treat him like God. Yeah, and it starts with, you give him something to eat. So we subsisted on that as Buddhist alms mendicants in Hindu India. And we visited the four holy sites. And I remember walking out of the first village, a very poor village in Bihar. If it doesn't get much poorer than Bihar in India. Yeah, that's where the Buddha lived. The word Bihar, by the way, is the same word as in Brahma, Vihara. Yeah, the word Vihara is the root for the word Bihar in India. It means just abode. Place. So we walked out there into that village and we started. We didn't know what to do. We could a little bit of Hindi. So we walked into that village. We took off our shoes as our good Buddhist monks do when they go through the village. And then we sat on the tree there. There was a sala tree. Yeah, a ficus, what it is called here. And we decided to chant. So we chanted, we recited some Buddhist thing. And then some of the men came, and then some of the women came and started to ask questions, very polite and at a distance. And after a while, they asked, have you eaten today? And we said, no, we haven't eaten today. So some hand movements were made, and then women disappeared in the kitchen and produced some rice. And I remember going, We talked with these people. We tried to tell them what we knew about the Buddhist teaching as good as we could in Hindi. And we walked out of that village, and I realized we were completely dependent on these people. Yeah, we didn't have any backup. We didn't have money. We didn't have anybody awaiting us. We were there on our own, so we completely dependent on these people. And yet, I knew I had a little torch in my luggage. Yeah, and that little torch was probably more worth than some of these people earned in a week. So I was completely struck, and I felt I'd never in my life been anywhere near as generous as these people had been with me. So this was a very powerful experience, and it connected me with a tradition of gratitude that has, I understood this later, that has enabled Buddhist teachings to come down to me. I could find these Buddhist teachings in England or in India or in Thailand, where I've lived many years. I could find these teachings, not just because of the famous name that is on the book, yeah? The famous teachers we know of, yeah? Aryadeva, Vasubandhu, Nagarjuna, Buddhaghosa, Dharmakirti, Chandrakirti. We know these names on the books, but we don't know the people who made these books possible. Yeah? Thousands and thousands and hundred thousands of people who kept a tradition alive. That's why you and I sit here today. You may not think yourself a Buddhist. You may not think yourself having anything to do with India. Maybe you're just interested in a little bit of clinical mindfulness. Who knows? Still, you and I are sitting here because that tradition is alive. And you know what kept this tradition alive? Not the famous teachers. It's the people who fed the famous teachers. It's the people who listened to the famous teachers, who built the monastery for the famous teachers, who printed the famous teacher's book, who asked the famous teacher the really good question so that the famous teacher could unpack. Yeah? Without those people, forget Buddhism, forget tradition, forget lineage, forget oral handing down of insights. So I'd like you to consider what you can contribute to this. Yeah? What you can contribute to. If you think this is any useful, what we're doing here, if you think this is worth that it continues, then I'd like you to consider how you can support this, how you can put in your effort, your intelligence, your money, your questioning, your good-heartedness, maybe your offer of work, your commitment to be part of something that makes such teachings possible. Things like an institution like Tovana, who does wonderful things in this country. Maybe your local sangha. Maybe your teachers. If you think this is worth, consider what you can do to make it possible that this goes on. Not just for you today, but it goes on tomorrow and the day after. And maybe for your kids. Yeah. I am very grateful for this. This is the most important thing in my life. And I trust that my fellow teachers would say you something very similar. It is something that is central and has made most of my decisions in my life. So if you think there is any value in this, and it's good to have people around like us, we appreciate if you make this possible that we can live. Yeah. Living on dana is a strange thing in a time when, you know, when things don't cost anything where I come from, it means that they have no value. It's either they're worthless, Or they're an advertisement gift, yeah. If anything else that has value costs something where I come from. So it's a strange concept, dana, in a time to where everything that has value costs something and things are measured by their value. It's a strange thing to try to convince people that generosity is at the heart of practice, that generosity is the direct opposite of attachment and identification. That letting go begins with being generous with what one has, one's time, one's energy, one's resources. So people think, okay, dana, does this stand something like a tip? Yeah. Or it's a cut, you know. I have a bonus. If my corporation performs well, I get a cut on the turnover. Yeah. So dana is either something you know, you give us a tip, or it's me being a successful manager, having a, forgot what is called in English, I have a cut of the success rate, yeah?
Share.
It's not technically a share, isn't it? Umsatzprovision. Commission, yeah. So consider Dana is neither a tip nor it's a, nor is it a commission. It's something that makes possible that this continues. None of us have great ambitions to become rich. But obviously, we have bills that come in like you have. So consider whether some of your gratitude for this, whether some of your commitment to practice, and some of your wish to discontinue can translate in specific forms of generosity. For Tovana, you can become a member day, you know, for the teachers, and yeah. And if you want to have more details, Ron will tell you more details.
אז בדיוק עכשיו חשבתי על זה שהשנה תובנה חוגגת 20. כן, מזל טוב. בעצם הקורס הראשון של תובנה היה ב-91, אבל כעמותה תובנה קיימת מ-95, שזה בדיוק 20 שנה. ורוב השנים תובנה בעצם לא התנהלה בדרך הזאת שאנחנו מתנהלים היום של הדנה, ובעצם רק לפני, אם אני לא טועה, ב-2008, את זוכרת? לדעתי ב-2008 הייתה איזושהי החלטה בעמותה לעבור לזה שרוב הקורסים יהיו בדנה מלאה, וזה היה מין קפיצת אמונה כזאת, איך העמותה תוכל להתקיים, והעמותה מתקיימת. מתקיימת מ-2008, זה כבר, תעזרו לי במתמטיקה, כבר שבע שנים. כבר שבע שנים והעמותה מתקיימת. היא מתקיימת עד כדי כך שעכשיו אפילו צריכים לשפץ פה את האולם, וזה הקורס הראשון בעצם שזוכה לשבת באולם המשופץ החדש. עדיין לא הסתיים הכל, יש כוונות את הכניסה שמה לשפר, אבל לכל מי שישב פה בעבר, העולם נראה הרבה הרבה יותר טוב ממה שהיה. אז באמת, הגישה הזאת של הדנה, שבה רוב הקורסים של תובנה מתקיימים, יש קורסים מסוימים שמתקיימים רק שאנחנו מבקשים תשלום בעצם להוצאות המיידיות של הקורס, מראש, והתשלום הדן על המורים היא בעצם תמיד בשילה של דנה. אבל בעצם רוב הקורסים, כמו הקורס הזה, הוא מתנהל לגמרי בדנה, ואנחנו לא מבקשים מראש שום תשלום. והכוונה היא, גם כמו שהקין שלנו דיבר, הדרמה זה משהו שאנחנו קיבלנו ואנחנו מאוד רוצים שזה יישאר ככה, זאת אומרת, עם ידיים פתוחות, שכל אחד יכול לבוא ולא תהיה שום התנאיה. זה צד אחד. וצד שני, זה התרגול דנה של כל אחד מאיתנו, ואנחנו לא מפרסמים מראש שום מחיר שהוא נקוב לקורס, אלא כל אחד בסיום של הקורס יכול להחליט לפי המצב שלו, לפי המצב של הלב שלו, מצב של הארנק שלו, המצב של ההבנה שלו, כמה עכשיו מתאים לו וכמה הוא יכול לתת.